Hello, and welcome to the Science Podcast for November 16, 2007. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, a special podcast on robots to go with our special section on robots in the magazine. We'll hear about programming robots to behave like cockroaches, robot ethics, the DARPA robot challenge to build robots that can obey traffic laws, and robot survival in extreme environments.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the Science Society, publishers of Science Magazine, advancing science and technology for the benefit of all people. The American Association for the Advancement of Science at www.aaas.org.
If a robot is about the same size as a cockroach, smells like a cockroach, and, here's the tricky part, behaves like a cockroach, then to other cockroaches it may as well be a cockroach, even if it looks like a box of matches. José Alois and colleagues report in a paper that they've managed to influence the behavior of groups of cockroaches using these matchbox-sized robots, learning more about sociality in animals and, simultaneously, autonomous groups of robots. I spoke with Alois from his office at the Université Libre de Bruxelles in Belgium.
And so there are two sides. On one side, the biological side, we're trying to understand sociality in animals. And on the other side, engineers are very interested in building autonomous systems, group of robots that are able to solve problems. And then at the end, we have a mixed system composed of animals and robots that are somehow cooperating. And so that's what we call a mixed society. And so the next step will be to build groups of artificial systems and animals that will be capable of cooperating to solve problems. So the machine is listening and perceiving what the animals are doing, and the animals are perceiving and understanding what the machines are telling them. And so from those interactions, we want to understand what kind of cooperation we can build between artificial system and animals.
Why did you start with cockroaches?
So social insects are very well known for their very highly sophisticated social behavior. But cockroaches are not social insects like bees or ants. They're called just pre-social or gregarious insects because they live in groups. They don't have a highly structured society. We wanted to show that also in those pre-social insects, they can use collective decision-making based on self-organization like ants and bees do. Not everything is, of course, self-organized, but part of their collective behavior is self-organized. And it was the first time we've shown that those gregarious insects are also able to make collective decisions based on self-organization mechanism. And why cockroaches? Also because they have a very good model at the lab, and so they're easy to breed, their biology is rather well known. So for the experiments, it was a good model. And finally, to interact with robots, we decided to go for the American cockroach. The size of that cockroach is about 3 to 4 centimeters, and it corresponds to the size of micro-robots that engineers are able to build for the moment. For all those reasons, we decided to go for the cockroaches.
Now, you said collective decision-making. What did you do to the robots so that the cockroaches accepted the robots as part of the collective?
Yes, so in cockroaches, recognizing each other is not based on visual cues. So they don't, of course, they have eyes and they see, but they don't recognize each other mainly by visual cues. They recognize each other by smell. They have those long antennas, and those antennas are their nose. In fact, they smell the others, and they can tell if it's a cockroach or not. So the robot doesn't look at all like a cockroach. It looks like a matchbox, an electronic matchbox. So the visual cue is irrelevant in this case. But on the other side, we've put the pheromone that tells the cockroach, I am a cockroach. So it's a blend of chemical molecules that we have extracted from the cockroaches and that we spray on papal filter, and then we wrap the robot with those papal filters. And that smell makes the cockroach believe they are smelling another cockroach. And so the robots are accepted. If we don't use those pheromones, if you just put the bare robots inside of a group of cockroaches, they're afraid of the robot because it's a mobile thing. They don't recognize it as a member of the group, so they try to avoid interacting with it. So the trick to lure them was to use this chemical smell, this chemical pheromone that is left on the surface of the robot.
Now, any concern that the pheromones were simply acting as bait? You mentioned that it acted as a lure.
Yes, exactly. And it's used like that. It's well known. You can lure many insects by using pheromones. But usually what people do is it's a static system. You put the pheromone to some place and then it's attracting, for instance, the insects to that place. But here, the amount of pheromone we use it is the amount that one cockroach would carry. And second, the robot is mobile. So the pheromone is not trapped on one place. So it's moving around, participating in what's going on in the system. So the solution that will emerge from the system is not predefined specifically by human interference with the system. Like, for instance, if you want the cockroaches to go to one shelter, you would leave a huge drop of pheromone below that shelter, and of course, all cockroaches will go there. But what we say is that, what we try to show is that, okay, we don't do that. We just put the pheromone on the robot so they're accepted. And then the robots interacting with the cockroach will decide somehow. The interaction between the robots and the cockroaches will make the system decide which shelter is going to be selected. So it's a dynamical system. And the solution is not necessarily predefined at the beginning. So you don't need to know the number of shelters, the quality of the shelter. No, all that is left to the system to decide.
So the collective of robots and cockroaches together was to go to a particular shelter. What was distinctive about one shelter versus another?
So there are two sets of experiments. In the first set of experiments, the shelters are perfectly equivalent. So there is no difference between the shelters perceived by the insects or by the robots. That trick is used to show that there is a collective decision-making process going on, because if they all gather together below one of the shelter, which means that they have somehow agreed between quotes to go to that shelter, because there's no particular reason to choose left or right in that case. If they would choose randomly, you will end up with 50% of individuals on one side and 50% on the other side. And in that case, we observe that we get 90% of individuals below the same shelter, which means they have decided as a group. They have selected that shelter as a group. So they have somehow agreed. And the second set of experiments is to make them choose between a dark shelter and a lighter one. So cockroaches naturally prefer to go to dark places. So the darker the shelter, the better for them. And so we decided to show that by modulating the behavior of the robot, making the robots prefer lighter shelter, so the opposite of the cockroaches, we are going to be able to modulate the collective decision-making of the system, which means that the whole group, the mixed group, the cockroaches and the robots, will end up in the lighter shelter much more often than in a natural system without the robots. So many times the robots were driven somehow by the system to the dark shelter because they also take into account the presence of others. So although they individually prefer to be in the light shelter, because of social interaction, they end up with the whole group in the dark place. And it's the same for the cockroaches. Although they prefer to be in the dark place, because they take into account the presence of others, including the robots, they end up in the light place because of the social interactions, and not because of the individual preference only.
Any thought that this might ever extend to people and robot interactions?
Probably not, because the more cognition you have in the system, the more complicated it's going to be to interact. So in one sense, we have already some kind of luring system in televisions and radio that are broadcasting information and influencing people. But if you want a robot to interact with human beings, then it will not resort only on such simple mechanisms like self-organization. You will have a highly cognitive processes to take into account. And so it's a completely different world. We are studying systems where mainly cognitive processes are present, but are somehow much simpler than in human beings.
All right. Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome.
José Alois is lead author of a paper on the social integration of robots in groups of cockroaches. Read more about it in this week's Science.
Is it time for robot ethics or roboethics?
Robert J. Sawyer is a Hugo and Nebula Award-winning science fiction author.
Science fiction writers dealt with the prospect of roboethics decades ago. And whether it was Isaac Asimov's Three Laws of Robotics, or Jack Williamson's simple directive for robots to serve and obey and guard men from harm, the results of imposing ethics on robots were always disastrous. But that doesn't prevent us, or our governments, from trying. For example, South Korea already has set ethical guidelines concerning robot functions, and Japan has issued policies about how robots should behave and be treated. Why ethics for robots? They're slaves, after all. The word robot coming from the Czech word robota, meaning forced labor. Shouldn't robots just follow instructions and do what we want them to do? But therein lies the problem, because we want robots to be in our homes, look after the elderly, play with our children. And that kind of forced labor will mean developing guidelines, like the European Robotics Research Network plans to do, so that robots are safe, secure, private, traceable, and identifiable. But the United States has yet to jump on the robo-ethics bandwagon. And the reason for that reluctance may be that many U.S. robots are created for the military and are designed to harm humans. Still, it is likely that the most interesting litigation defining robot responsibilities and rights will emerge in the United States. That's because, for starters, in the state of Michigan, a jury awarded $10 million to the family of the first human ever killed by a robot, accidentally, in 1979. At that time, it was the largest personal injury award in that state's history. So many of the issues that roboethicists are dealing with today have already been explored in the pages of science fiction. Those trying to fashion rules for robots would do well to turn to science fiction as a guide. And although it's true that robots started out as slaves, it's also true that science fiction has already dramatized their emancipation, showing us a future in which biological and artificial entities live together in peace and harmony. I'm Robert J. Sawyer, and I very much look forward to that future.
Robert J. Sawyer is a Hugo and Nebula Award-winning science fiction author. You can read his full editorial on robot ethics in this week's Science. Over the last few years, DARPA, the Defense Advanced Research Projects Agency in the United States, has sponsored a robot challenge. The goal? Build robots that can autonomously drive a vehicle from one location to another, avoiding obstacles and other pitfalls. Science News writer Adrian Cho reports in this week's issue that this year's challenge included an additional constraint that robots may not be used to: obey all the traffic laws of California.
This is a very weird event. This was DARPA's Urban Challenge, which was a contest in which several teams built robot cars that could guide themselves, and the robots were placed on the roads of an abandoned Air Force base in Victorville, California, and they had to drive around essentially all day navigating different routes and finding parking places and things like that without colliding and supposedly while obeying all of the California traffic laws.
Okay, cars without drivers. That's pretty weird. Was there anything else?
It was half robot competition and half media circus. It turned out that spectators weren't able to get out on the course because obviously DARPA didn't want a robot car running somebody over. So there was exactly one place where you could watch this race from as the cars made their way around one turn. And because of that, DARPA actually televised the thing. They hired a helicopter, and the helicopter filmed the entire event, and we all watched it inside this enormous tent on these three jumbo television screens, and the play-by-play was provided by a couple of the stars of the cable TV show Mythbusters, and it was very strange. It was a bit like watching NASCAR and a bit like watching the O.J. Simpson low-speed car chase all those years ago, so it was a very, very strange event.
It sounds really surreal. Why are they putting on this challenge?
Well, the federal government, Congress, has mandated that the military should have 30% of all its combat vehicles be autonomous by 2015. And DARPA's charge is to help develop the technologies that the military needs to protect its soldiers. So DARPA, to stimulate the development of these cars, has held a series of these challenges. They held one in 2004 called the Grand Challenge, and there the robot simply had to cross 142 miles of open desert one by one, and none of them made it more than 8 miles. They held a second Grand Challenge in 2005, and at that time, 5 robots from 4 different teams managed to complete the course. And this challenge, the Urban Challenge, was a much more demanding challenge in that instead of simply having to make it across some static landscape, now the robots had to feel out each other's positions and guide themselves around each other and avoid collisions, and at the same time obey these rules of the road. So this was much closer to trying to get to the point where you have a truly autonomous automobile.
What are some of the technologies that make these cars capably driven by robots, assuming they were capably driven?
Well, some of them were, and some of them were not so much. But by and large, they did a very impressive job. So any robotic car basically has 3 important technological elements. One is the sensors that allow the car to perceive its surroundings and other cars. 2 is some amount of computing, usually a large amount of computing, that enables the car to process the information from the sensors and then make decisions based on certain rules that it has stored in its memory. And 3rd is the software itself that tells the car how to make its decisions, how to set strategies, how to interpret the rules if it gets in a situation where it gets stuck. So when you look at it, all these cars were outfitted with these really wild sensors. In particular, there was one that many of them depended on, which looked a bit like a sort of high-tech coffee grinder with a sort of conical device that would sit on top and spin around. And this was a LIDAR, which is a device that shoots out pulses of laser light and then times them as they reflect back. And from using that timing information, it can sense where objects are. And this spinning LIDAR shoots up 64 beams, and it shoots them all around, and it's actually able to make a sort of 3-dimensional map of the entire surroundings. So they use that. They use some other LIDAR scanners, radar, digital cameras. But by and large, the sensors were things that could be purchased. What was really unique to the various cars was the programming. And one researcher from Stanford told me that driving is really a software problem and not a hardware problem. So when the rubber hits the road, if you will, the better teams are the teams that have developed the algorithms that enable the car to figure out where it should go and how to avoid collisions and how to interpret various situations.
With it shooting out these laser beams, that doesn't seem like it's something that would be terribly useful for the military at this point.
That's absolutely true, and that's really one of the nice little ironies of this challenge. The challenge was a big success, and it's very easy to imagine that these technologies will find their way into civilian automobiles. But exactly as you say, with LIDAR or with radar, you have these so-called active sensors that shoot out some sort of a beam and then wait for it to come back. And the very fact that you're shooting a beam of microwaves or laser light out into the environment means you're giving your position away. So while I'd be willing to speculate that there will be at least some form of robotic guidance built into civilian cars by 2015, that seems entirely possible. Actually making these things, these autonomous vehicles for military applications, may be harder, and it will be interesting to see if they can actually meet this mandate of 2015 for having military vehicles. It may turn out that the only vehicles they can do this for are ones that are not in the direct line of combat, because the ones in the line of combat would just give away their position.
Or might that be another reason for another DARPA challenge down the road?
That's possible. It's not exactly clear whether or not DARPA will do this again. Tony Tether, the director of DARPA, noted that, as he put it, DARPA never finishes anything. They only prove that it's possible, and then they wait for industry to jump in and take a project from the research phase, which DARPA supports, to the development phase. And as an observer, I have to say, it seemed to me that because 6 robots managed to complete this task, and 3 of them did really well, it seemed to me that it's possible that it has reached the stage where it needs to go from research to development. And perhaps DARPA will back off. Tether also made the point that apparently Congress has legislated that DARPA can no longer simply decide on its own that it's going to award one of these multi-million dollar prizes. They now have to get approval from Congress, so that may make it trickier too.
Was it $2 million for the winner?
That's right. On the other hand, the engineers say that these systems, as good as they are and as impressive as they are not really ready for the open road yet. Sebastian Thrun, the leader of the Stanford team, pointed out that the collision rate is still too high. There were a couple of fender benders. And that ultimately what you want are robotic cars that can talk to each other so that they're able to cooperate to avoid collisions or perhaps to make traffic flow much faster on freeways during rush hour. And that hasn't been demonstrated yet. The cars can sense each other, but they can't cooperate. So a number of researchers were really excited about the possibility of having a challenge in which the robots could cooperate.
All right. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks, Rob.
Science News writer Adrian Cho reports on the DARPA Robot Challenge. Read the article in this week's Science. Scientists have sent robots to the depths of the ocean and beyond our solar system. And so far, the robots are engineered to serve as our surrogates, going where we cannot yet go because of the danger, lack of technology, or the prohibitive cost to send people instead. In a review in this week's Science, marine technologist James Bellingham emphasizes that more and more, robots will need to carry out complex tasks without human supervision. I spoke with Bellingham from his office at the Monterey Bay Aquarium Research Institute in California.
The article's basically about our need to explore what are increasingly harsh and distant environments and the increasing use of robots to do so. So we need to know what's going on in places ranging from inaccessible regions like the Arctic to sort of the far reaches of the solar system. It's partly just our desire to explore, but on Earth also our increasing need to understand climate as a whole rather than just climate in the places which are easy for us to get to. And in many of these regions, it's very expensive for people to travel to, much less stay for any extended period. That includes the deep ocean. That includes, of course, the far parts of the solar system. And so as a consequence, this solution has been to use robots to do that exploration.
Well, as you said, we've had robots in use now for quite some time, but there's always a call to send people like to the bottom of the ocean or off even to Mars now. Is it possible that we're seeing the end of the usefulness of robots in these particular two arenas, or is it just a different type of priorities that these folks have as opposed to those who want to develop further robots?
Well, there's some tasks that can really only be done by people. And for those tasks, you send people to that environment. And, you know, there's really no substitute for a human in the task of exploration. But then there's a lot of things that we need to do but can't afford to send a human to do. And for those types of tasks, robots let us do the exploration tasks and maintain more or less the pervasive or continuous presence in environments which otherwise we simply couldn't afford to.
What's the biggest constraint or the biggest argument against robots as explorers?
Well, I think that perhaps there's a fear that we have at times about letting the robot make the decision. So I actually think that in the scientific community as a whole, robots are quite well accepted and in growing use. So I don't actually see there being any particular resistance to the use of robots as tools for exploration. Perhaps the one area is in regions where these robots are truly out of contact. So in the far reaches of the solar system, when communication travel times are very long and the data rates are very low, or in the deep ocean, where you're out of communication altogether until you return to the surface, you have a choice between having the robot do very simple things, which you've programmed ahead of time, or letting the robot respond more to the environment and perhaps make choices about what measurements it takes and where it goes. And I think that this is the area where there's enormous room for improvement in the capabilities of robots. And on the part of scientists, perhaps a little bit of concern about letting a robot make choices about what data that they are going to get.
So it sounds like the greatest problem with robots searching the great unknown is the great unknown itself.
Yeah, I guess that's one way of putting it. I don't think that there's, you know, a fear, you know, any fear of this. As a matter of fact, there have been a number of pivotal events which have really demonstrated the importance of having the robot capable of making decisions. I mean, when a robot is landing on a distant planet, having it capable of looking at its trajectory as it enters and make decisions about whether to fire rockets so as to make sure it has a safe landing, I think everyone would agree that that's a good thing to do. So I don't think there's any real question about the desire of people to have these robots have increasing autonomy.
Do you think full autonomy is ever going to be something that people will allow robots to have? Or do you think we'll always have that communication capacity to change software once the robot has gotten to the destination?
Well, for the foreseeable future, these robots are functioning as our surrogates. And so we want to communicate with them. And we want their data back. And we want them to accomplish actions which satisfy the goals that we've set for them. So they're not, you know, kind of establishing a separate society, if you will, out there. They're really functioning as extensions of us. They just happen to be extensions of us that can be productive even when we can't talk to them. And so I think that's the way I would think about this class of robots. You know, you could imagine all kinds of robots, you know, in the distant future, which you might send to a planet that might do a lot of preparatory work before humans came. And those would be maybe a different class of robot. You know, they might actually manufacture fuel for the human return visit, or they might actually help construct shelter in a remote environment. And those wouldn't be exploration robots, but they certainly would build on a lot of the software tools and capabilities that we're going to create in the process of making more complex exploration robots. I mean, these are just sort of generally useful capabilities, right? I mean, if you can make robots that can take care of themselves in previously unmapped environments and in harsh environments, then these are systems which can be used in many, many places here on Earth to the benefit of humans. So it's just a logical place to invest.
Well, to those general capabilities, are the two groups, the space exploration robot engineers and the undersea robot engineers, are they learning from one another, or are the budgets so and the projects so vastly different, with space having so much more money, that the learning is only happening sort of in one direction from space to undersea?
Oh, that's a great question. So first of all, yes, I think there is good communication between the two communities. And as a matter of fact, Kana, my co-author on this paper, worked at NASA Ames, where he worked on the Mars Exploration Rover missions, and is now working in the ocean environment. But there's a history going back many years of interaction. And I think that interaction is getting stronger. Because if you think about it, the early space missions were of probe, you know, those early space missions, the probes were really largely pre-programmed.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas you can't do that for an underwater vehicle. You know, because a space probe, if you're flying by Mars or if you're flying by Jupiter, those are things where you know what's going to happen, you can anticipate it, and you can tell the machine exactly what to do. Whereas in the underwater environment, you don't know what the shape of the seafloor is, and the vehicle has to be able to respond to that shape of the seafloor in order to not hit it if, for example, you're doing a bottom map. So in the early days of underwater robots, there was much more of a need to respond to the environment, and so some of the early underwater systems actually had more capability in that sense than some of the space missions. Now, on the other hand, the budget levels for space are many, many times the budget levels for underwater robots. So as a consequence, you can really see certain types of capabilities being championed in the space community, which it's hard to champion in the underwater community because you simply don't have the budget to push. But in terms of a dialogue and a sharing of ideas and a common sense of purpose, I think there's a great interaction between the space community and the underwater robotics community.
James Bellingham is lead author of a review on robotics in remote and hostile environments. Read more about it in this week's Science. If you missed our regular Science Now segment, it will be back next week. And you can check out the latest science news at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. For now, that wraps up the November 16th, 2007 special science podcast on robots, to go along with a special section on robots in this week's issue. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.